Lil, put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
Their guest sat cross-legged on the floor. He was one of the Sison, English, but Kat wasn't prepared for how awkward he looked, knees akimbo, waiting for his refreshments. She managed to turn her smile into a welcome. After all, Kat and her mam had been hosts of Garth Kellyn since Princess Eleanor's passing last summer, and good hosts were expected to serve their guests. Just a few teasing words there from Spirit Sight, Last of the Gifted, Book One, one of a duo of fantastic productions, which is focusing on our author of the week today, which, of course, is a new direction for award-winning children's author, Marie Powell. Marie's with us now from Saskatchewan or thereabouts in Canada. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show, Alex. Nice to meet you.
Absolute delight. And let's just get some of the credits there. Winner of the Moonbeam Young Adult Fiction, already sort of doing extremely well. Wales, 1282, A World at War. Catherine can see the future in a drop of water. Her brother Hugh can take the shape of any bird or animal. Robin Pierce, it sounds just like your place, basically, in many ways. Is this the case, Robin Pierce?
It does sound like my neighborhood. Absolutely, yes.
All right.
I love the fact that I need to tell Marie one thing. Alex can actually pronounce my first and my last name. During this broadcast, I put it to you, Marie, to try and get you to get him to pronounce the town name of where I live.
All right. Well, I take that challenge.
Yeah. All right.
We can do this.
Radio history will be made.
We will develop through that whole process. Now, I've already All started right. reading because I felt I had to purchase both of these texts. And I've started reading Spirit Sight, the selection with the horse, the connections from there. You already seem to have captured the magic of this land of mists and valleys and dragons and Merlin and all of the sort of elements that come through that. Has it been something that you've always been fascinated by? Has it been a connection from the Canada sort of experience that you thought, actually, at the end of the day, Wales is where my heart is? How has it been going?
Yes, absolutely. I'm like, my grandfather was Welsh, but he died before I was born, right? And my father always told me stories. Like, basically, my father read to me every night. I'm the youngest by a lot of four kids, and the other three kids were in their teenage years, and so my mother was kind of occupied with them, and dad got me sort of, you know, after school and evening and whatnot. And so, like, I don't remember when he didn't read to me. He just always read to me. And most of the time, he if he couldn't find something to read, or if we were between books, he'd just tell me stuff, like tell stories. So I kind of, I knew about the Welsh connection really young, and just always, and we had, like, where I went to church, I was an Anglican, and we had an Anglican church, and the minister was from Wales, so everything was sung, right? So the entire church service was sung, and so, and we had some Welsh speakers who were, like, the elders who would get up and speak and read the, you know, lessons or whatever they are that they do in church, and so I had that kind of accent kind of, you know, floating around in my head all this time. And then when I was in my, believe it or not, like, there wasn't really anything we knew about him other than he was from Wales, right? Which is kind of, you know, it's a small country, but it's not that small, right? And there's this north and south thing, and, you know, so I didn't really know a lot about it. But when I was in my 40s, I was a single parent. I have two kids, and I just decided I wanted to know more, you know, and I was a magazine writer. So I thought, well, I'll use that. I'll, you know, do this travel writing. Why not? Right. And I would plan a trip to Wales, and I kind of planned it myself with the help of, like, Visit Wales and, you know, things like that. And when we got to Wales, I found out all kinds of stuff I had no idea about. I didn't find my relatives, oddly enough, until I connected with them on Ancestry. But I did have the chance to kind of walk around there and kind of get the feel of, and it was kind of weirdly like coming home, yeah, you know?
Well, again, you know, there's no place like home. There's no place like North Carolina, as we welcome to the segment of the program, Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica? Have you survived your Thanksgiving celebrations?
Hello. Yes, I have enjoyed Thanksgiving completely. So much food.
Of course, in Canada, you have Thanksgiving on a completely different day. So
completely different day. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a totally sort of different system from that. One of the things I'm very impressed with respect to certainly the opening lines of Spirit Sight, is you actually have not just a glossary, but also a pronunciation list, which certainly, as Robin will tell, is really important for the likes of myself, who not quite Sassenach, to use the Scottish scenario, but certainly we're based in that whole sequence. So, you know, obviously we go through sort of Huel, Hugh as in Hugh, and Catherine or Cat, Hugh's younger sister. You even got the classic Llewellyn Griffith, as in Prince of Wales, Llewellyn Griffith, which is great. And of course, Llewellyn's wife, Eleanor de Montfort, which is great. Even the fact that Gwen Thian is pronounced as Gwen Thian. It's a whole new world, Robin. Certainly, I feel as though I'm making progress here.
Marvellously well. I mean, I am truly impressed. The only thing that I would say is it's not Hewell. It's Howell.
Howell. Now, in North Wales, though, they give it a bit more of a Scottish Q thing to it, right? So, cool, you know. So,
because north, we speak proper Welsh, you see.
Yes.
Not like that mob down in South Wales. We can't even understand them.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, the critical aspect of this, and a bit like North Carolina, South Carolina, I mean, I see the map you've included in the book, which is 1282. We've actually got the location in North Wales. And indeed, Robin, you were saying that Marie isn't just around the corner from you. It's just her backdrop is.
Yes.
So for the benefit of the radio listener, just share with us, Marie, what's the backdrop you've actually got there?
It's okay, Robin, I'm going to say this and you'll just have to correct me if I'm incorrect, all right? But it's Casta Ghibéire, which is the castle, Béire Castle, which would be in around Dolgellau.
Yes, that's right.
In Merioneth, what was Merioneth?
Yeah.
Casta, so I'm actually pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the castle that my character, Catherine, if she had married the guy she was betrothed to, would be the lady of this castle. So it's the one I love the best as a backdrop on Zoom.
back in the 13th century, which is obviously the case from that point of view.
Did you visit that particular area when you were in Wales?
Yes. Yeah. We spent a day, a very rainy day, wandering around. It took us a while to find it. We had to go kind of like we had a car and like as a North American driver, I've often thought to myself that, you know, if we had like the chance in our penal system to do something a little bit more humane, but that would still be a good punishment for someone, I would actually sentence them to driving through North Wales for like a week or two, you know, because it's like, for North Americans, it's like we're used to shoulders on the road, you know, and being able to see. Well, and bear in mind, I'm actually from the plains, like the prairies, you know, we call it prairies in Canada. But so where I am, where I live, was at one time a glacial lake. So it's like flat, like we're talking flat, right? So this is South Saskatchewan. It's different. Saskatchewan's huge, so there's like all kinds of different terrain, you know. But basically, to go from that to Snowdonia mountain driving, you know, kind of like this, and like
welcome to the neighborhood.
No shoulder. Yeah, there's no shoulders. There's the only shoulder you get on the road is like a cliff of rock on one side,
and a
totally sheer drop on the other side. And good luck to you for staying in the middle, you know, because there's cars coming both directions down this.
Oh yeah, road, yeah, with about a millimeter in between wing mirrors.
Yeah. Pretty much,
Did you visit Carnarvon Castle when you were here?
I did, Carnarvon. I've been to...
When was this, just out of interest?
I've been a couple of times. So the first time we came, we stayed on a sheep farm near Dolwyth Allen. So I saw that castle.
That's a bit of a shocker, Marie, actually having a sheep farm in Wales. That is a shocker. But
I know. We don't grow... We farm, right?
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of cattle or anything.
Leave it to the Americans. They grow the sheep from genetic sort of portions, et cetera. You know, everything else, they sort of breed sheep, but just a different line. Sorry, Jessica.
Yep, sorry. Breed, yes, thank you.
Well, here's a shocker for you, Marie. Mm-hmm. I was actually working as a custodian in Carnarvon Castle for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 2015 through to 2017.
Okay, I was not there those years.
I couldn't have been on duty then.
You couldn't have been. But we did take a guided tour around Carnarvon because, you know, that's such an interesting castle, right?
I know the guide well.
Yeah. See, yeah. When I first got there, I didn't know those weren't Welsh castles.
No, they were built by the English to keep the Welsh where we are.
Yeah.
Which many people would say is a good thing.
many people would say, yeah, not only did they need those big castles to keep the Welsh in line, they needed 13 of them. Right? Yeah. There's 13 of those darn things around Wales, yeah. And
people
I had no
idea. Come up to me because I was working on the entrance gate and say, you know, oh, these are English castles. They're not even Welsh castles. And all I said was, yeah, well, and now we Welsh are charging you to come in. What do you think?
With that kind of fortitude, Jessica, you could now see why President Trump got his idea for a wall across Mexico. It was a similar sort of thing, basically, except it was England and Wales as opposed to Mexico and North America. It's just a thought there. Yeah. Jessica, have you had a chance?
Off a dyke.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to have a look at the text with respect to a water site and indeed, of course, the first site that's actually there and the thoughts and words of Marie and any questions you'd like to put in at this stage? Otherwise, we'll just start talking about Wales for the majority of the time.
I don't know. I am enjoying hearing all about Wales. It's such a unique setting for a book where like medieval fantasy is concerned because I don't typically see that. So I think that's very, very unique. It's nice to see it. I was going to ask, what do you think is the most rewarding part of having written this series?
Getting it finished, getting it published. No, actually, it was just the chance to kind of marry the idea of history with the idea of magic, right? Because, I mean, obviously, in spite of the fact that we were talking earlier about, you know, people in Robin's neighborhood, there really aren't people in Wales who can transform into animals and all that kind of stuff, right? So this is not how this particular war was run or solved. But what was interesting for me was what I found when I came to it was a lot of gaps, you know, like there's information from this particular invasion that's just gone. Like we don't really know where was the army, which castle fell when, and all that kind of stuff. It was destroyed, like literally, deliberately destroyed. So in some way, it was not vindictive, but rewarding to be able to kind of go back to this period of history and find out stuff, you know? Because I mean, there was a deliberate attempt to hide the information that came out of this. So you can kind of get the sense that it was pretty brutal, you know? And I wanted to have that sense behind the book. Like I wanted there to be some real threat in the book, but at the same time, I wanted there to be some hope, you know, because what got me when I got to Wales and my kids as well, is when we were looking around, like the language is back, you know, the language is first, and the things they lost in 1283 were language and law and basic freedoms, right? So that language, it was literally on the placards that we were reading as we went around the little Welsh castles, was if you, for example, spoke Welsh in the town after 5 o'clock, you could lose your head. You could be killed. You could be imprisoned and actually, you know, killed for that, right? For just speaking your own language. And the law was changed. The English came in and they got rid of Welsh law, which had been a law form for 500 or 600 years. They got rid of it and replaced it with English law. You know, they replaced the town names. Like when we were driving to Denbigh, which is Dinbych in Welsh, and it's spelled differently. So the English had respelled the name, right? And on the sign on the highway, I swear this is true. It was like we couldn't find the name Denbigh anywhere to go, you know, to figure out where to turn to get to this town. And then we took a good look at the sign on the side of the road. And I swear somebody had painted out the word Denbigh and written in white paint over top of it the word Dinbych, which is D-Y-N-B-Y-C-H, right? And so like that was just a revelation. It was like, how could you keep your language after 800 years of that, of like serious persecution? How could the language just boom come back like this from the 1990s on? So that kind of thing inspired me. And what I wanted most was to kind of have an inspiring ending, kind of have them get some hope in there, you know, even though they lost everything.
If nothing else, it has been suggested, Marie, that effectively that would be the best way to actually sort out the COVID crisis, that simply you execute people who are actually sort of out after a certain period of time and therefore sort of slice the population down. It has to be said that historically the English have been very good at actually total suppression. You know, that's a way forward. Yeah. After all, we did give the world concentration camps in the Boer War. So, you know, I think the Germans took a few things from that, but what the hey. Anyway, before I actually sort of alienate any of our English listeners that are sort of remaining, yeah. I'll flag my Polish stuff up. Robin, any questions that you've got about a text of which it has been said by Eileen Cook, effectively, Marie Powell is a writer that is able to pull readers into her world and not let them go.
How difficult is it for you as a writer based in Saskatchewan, Canada, to write a book based in Wales and get the details right? Because, yes, you did a research trip over here, but surely that can only take you so far.
Yeah, that was the big challenge. And what took so long, I guess, about getting this book right is that I really wanted to get, I wanted there to be a sense of what was lost, you know, what the Welsh were like prior to 1282, 1283. And I wanted the sense of, you know, getting through that, the real sense of the landscape, because, you know, in Canada, we're big in the landscape idea, right? We're kind of big on the landscape. So I wanted there to be a lot of the natural, you know, what might have been there, what kind of animals, what kind of plants, what kind of things, you know, might they have seen, and where might they have really gone, and how long might it have taken them to get on foot from one place to another, and all that kind of stuff. So I did massive amounts. If you look in the back of Spirit Site, I have like a two or three pages of acknowledgements for people who helped me, because I really did a lot of correspondence. I found a lot of people who might know something about that time period or just about Wales in general. I had, I took a Welsh class at Nant Gyrddin in North Wales. I went there and actually...
Now that you were literally in my neighborhood.
Ah, good. That's beautiful.
About 6 miles from where I'm sitting right now.
Wow. I could talk for hours about that. Because, yeah. I mean, going down...
The brow of that hill, before you go down, you can actually see from the window that's behind me.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh. You know, that hill, that mountain, whatever it is, scared the heck out of me. We got down to the bottom.
That's another narrow, twisty road.
Even
no barriers.
And like it goes down, and then it goes like this, and then it goes down, and it's like I'm talking down. You know what I mean? Like, anyway, so it was crazy. But I did that.
No, I was going to say, Marie, there are people who are probably still recovering from the notion that you suggested that Wales could be the 21st century version of Australia in terms of convicts go there. So I don't know where we're having sort of other things in terms of just to actually learn to drive. Heaven only knows what Beth Gulliver would be saying. She's just passed her driving test. But as you rightly say,
Alex knows why I drive a four-wheel drive.
Yeah.
I love the glossary. Obviously, you've included the Nant-Paris River that's actually there from that point of view. You've included everything from Simon de Montfort onward, and indeed even Tulu, the term for family.
It's Taylor.
Yeah. There we are. I knew my Welsh pronunciation. It's non-existent. A Welsh prince's personal bodyguard. Llewellyn apparently had 160 in his Taylor.
Apparently, yeah, more than any other Welsh prince. That's what I've read anyway. Yeah. I hope that's true.
Again, something else Donald Trump might have learned about, but still, never mind. lots of sort of wonderful things from that. Jessica, over to yourself. Any further questions either about water site or indeed spirit site or second site, I think, the next one that comes through.
I would ask, did you incorporate any like traditional Welsh folklore in the magic system for your book?
Yeah, I did. So I was interested in the Welsh version of the fairies. I'm going to say this again, Robin, correct me, but the Tylwyth Teg, is that right?
Absolutely right. Okay. Yep.
So the Welsh version of fairies, which we don't know much about, we hear a lot about the Irish version, you know, and even the Scottish version of what fairies are and how they work. But the Welsh are a little darker, shall we say? A little more like the winter court, if you're into that magic system. But so I wanted to have some kind of dark magic, and the idea of, you know, that there were a bunch of legends about Arthur prior to the ones we usually think of, like the ones that, you know, run with Camelot and all of that. And the Welsh legends from the original are really crazy. It's like There's one guy in Arthur's court that apparently could drink a stream dry. There's another guy that could lift his mouth up over his head. I don't know. Like, you know, they're just nutsy, crazy stories. Yeah. And a lot of
early
warrior
legions
stories.
Of superheroes, obviously. Early superheroes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. They're, you know, so I was playing around with all these sort of, you can kind of expand your mind then, right? And what I wanted into the magic system was the sense that you could not just shapeshift into, and I might want a spoiler here, but not just shapeshift into one animal, like a werewolf or something like that, but that you could actually shift from animal to animal, right? Because I there is a couple of really cool legends about that. And there's even a story about a bard in the 1100s or whatever that was looking for a story to tell at a big festival. And he went outside and saw an animal doing this, you know, moving from shape to shape to shape. And so he created a story.
Are you sure it wasn't the mushrooms he was consuming at the time, Marie?
No, I've tasted the mushrooms from Wales, but I understand it is a crop there. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. But the idea that you know, magic is evolving, and magic is more than something that you can put rules. Like, you know, magic has rules, right? Like in most books, magic has rules. But I wanted a sense that the magic could evolve, that those rules could, you know, shift within a certain range of possibilities, right? So I was playing with how Welsh magic was different than other forms of magic systems that we've heard about, that we're more familiar with. And
Jessica, you're a keen Harry Potter fan. You've obviously sort of followed all those series. This is a young adult format. Will you be checking out Spirit Sight and Water Sight in the near future?
Yes, definitely.
Cool.
I love this kind of genre. And like I said, I've never seen a medieval fantasy take place in Wales. So everything about this is very interesting. And I heard that there's a map in the book, which is, it's beautiful when I see maps in books. So yeah, I'm definitely going to look into this.
Well, and we changed the map a bit so that in Spirit Sight, I didn't want to, you know, the names of the castles are very confusing in some ways, because there's a whole bunch of castles in Merioneth anyway, and around Merioneth that have the same sort of look. And you know, when you read fantasy, sometimes you kind of skim over the names when you can't pronounce them anyway, right? So I wanted the pronunciations in the book, but I also wanted to make some differentiation. So instead of saying Castellibere, which is a word that's hyphenated, connected together, I just called it Bere. So, you know, and then there's another castle that starts with a C, Cricieth, right?
Yeah.
So that the reader, when they were looking at it, could find it a little easier, I guess. And I'm lucky I had some younger readers reading it for me that, you know, clued me into these kinds of things. So I was trying to make it as easy to read as I could, but as authentic as I could at the same time. So I like the fact that you think it's interesting that it's in Wales, because I kind of felt that, but you know, there's a lot of tie-ins to other people's books that are based on Wales, like The Lord of the Rings, for example. A lot of his magic systems and a lot of his places are actually based on the Welsh. So it's like, I just wanted to foreground, you know, I wanted to make Wales kind of like the pivotal thing here that everybody was fighting for and everybody was losing, because they really did lose it in 1283, you know, in a sense of the freedom up that they might have had before that. They certainly lost a lot of freedoms there. And then they got it back again. So that's the cool thing, right?
Civilization. You're what bunch, Robin? We missed that.
I said we are a rowdy bunch over here.
All right.
don't they say Randy? Randy Welshman? Isn't that the idea, Robin?
Well, that's an entirely different thing.
Okay.
But yeah.
They may well say it, Marie, but not on broadcast media. At least not on...
Okay.
Never mind. That's a good twist. Well, all right, we'll work through that process. Now, clearly, you're a writer, an editor, a presenter, that all need a wordsmith we've actually got in terms of the mariepowell.ca website. Is there a preference at any particular time? Do you prefer the presenting? Do you prefer the writing? Is it the research? Or is it a case of, I mean, obviously you're a mum as well. So, I mean, all of those things put together. Yeah. How do you actually cope as a Renaissance woman?
Yes, well, I like that. I'm a Renaissance writer, yeah. I don't know that I cope all that well with it. I just, you know, you live, right? You just do it, you know. But to me, the best thing ever is when you start writing and you just kind of lose everything, you know, like you're just in the zone kind of. And like, it's almost like you can see the stuff, you know, it's almost like you're there kind of watching, you know, in the crowd kind of watching what's going on and seeing people moving through this strange alien environment in this strange alien time, you know.
And you're creating the characters as well. I know a mutual friend of both Robin's and myself, basically Sam Stone, I think does a similar thing with her text, whether crime, thriller, or indeed fantasy from that point of view. Do you have any favourite characters with respect to the two books we've been discussing today? I mean, are there any that you say, I like Hugh or Eleanor or Ares within that? Or is it a case of, no, they're just ciphers, they do as I tell them to do?
They don't. Yeah. No. I really love a lot of them, and I'm writing some short stories now because I got it kind of into Eleanor de Montfort, who is actually dead through this whole book, right? But she's kind of an influence on my character Catherine. And what I want to do is write a little bit about Eleanor because she was really fascinating. And again, there's not a lot known about her. That we know about Eleanor de Montfort, the mother of Eleanor, but we don't know a lot about the girl, you know. And at 17 years old, she left France on a boat with her brother, her mother had just died, to marry this guy she'd never met, who was like this incredibly fierce 50-year-old prince who had pulled the entire country of Wales together, right? It unprecedented kind of activity that he did during his lifetime. And she had been betrothed to him when she was like 5 years old, right? And now at 17, with nobody stopping her, she decides she's going through with this. And she travels to Wales. And at that time, it's in strife, you know, so her cousin is Edward the First, and she knows he doesn't like him. You know, she knows there's a lot of fighting going on. Her own father was exiled and all this, you know, or their family was exiled. Her father was brutally murdered and, you know, by Edward the First and so on. So, but she travels back into this and marries this guy, you know. Like, I really want to write about her just because we don't know why or how or, you know, how that happened. Again, it's a gap, and I really want to fill that gap. And I also like a lot of my secondary characters, so I kind of want to write about them too, you know. So I've got some things going on in
honestly,
the future.
It makes the journey of a North Carolina soul to England's Lincoln to actually do a term miles by comparison, really, Jessica, but never mind.
does.
We still carry on. I mean, just a quote from Watersight, Last of the Gifted Book 2, the fog surrounded her, obscuring Rhys who climbed behind her, but she drew it around her like a cloak. They needed stealth. Below them, the valley was full of English mercenaries hunting for Welsh heads. It didn't matter that only a handful of warriors remained. Women, children, any of them would satisfy the wretched king. It's got to be said, Marie, the English don't come out very well on this one. I mean, you know, if I'm looking at it from a PR perspective, I'd say got a bit of a work, a bit of a job on there, really.
Yeah, well, tough. You know, it's that kind of time period, right? But I do think I do have an English character that I kind of like also, which is the bad guy or the villain of this particular piece of
Water. Yeah, once again, Marie, standard North American thing, Hollywood. If you want a bad guy, have somebody who's got an English accent, for God's sake. Yep. You know, you're always going to be the villain.
Yeah, and he can speak Welsh. So, I mean, like, you know, he's a cool guy, kind of, right?
But, yeah, they're probably the worst, actually, Marie. They're probably the worst because you sort of have a mask on that part of you. Robin, any further thoughts from yourself?
Where do you go from here? I mean, are you going to make a trilogy or are you done with this particular world that you've created?
Well, you know, when I started Watersight, I thought I would be done at the end of it. But yeah, not quite, because there's still some loose ends at the end of Watersight that I'd like to pick up. And, you know, in the magic system, we were talking about magic earlier just with Jessica. It's like I have Spirit Sight. I have Watersight. I think the next one is Earth Sight. Yes, you know,
ooh,
and
so you're working your way through the elements.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that way. Yeah, it wasn't in my head when I began. I actually thought Watersight was the end, and then I got to the end of Watersight and wanted to move forward with it. So I do have some ideas.
What about an air site?
Well, this is like ether, right? Spirit site is kind of like ether. And, you know, like, yeah, there's places I can go with this, right? Yeah. And staying within the realm of the magic as well as the time period, which I absolutely am coming to love. I did have a lot of help with the research. I forgot to mention that earlier, too, is that I actually have a historical reviewer and I'm taking another medieval class from her. So I'm, I'm still learning about that time period and I still want to write about that. Yeah.
If you had fire sight, of course, you could actually have the eyes burnt out on that basis and no sight at all, really. But
or, yeah, that's an idea, actually. Someone who is sightless, right? Because that would have been really bad back in that time period. What would they have done? Yeah, how would they have survived? They couldn't inherit anything. And yeah, ooh, neat. See, well, ideas from everywhere.
That's the whole sequence. If people are keen to actually purchase copies of Spirit Sight and indeed Water Sight, they're obviously online. I've proven that by the fact I've downloaded them and read them myself from that point of view, working through my way through that. Are they available on all the usual channels?
Yes, all the usual channels. Amazon, you know, we have chapters here. I'm not sure what's in the UK in relation to that, but it would be in any bookstore. We have it in some actual physical bookstores. We have a bookstore here that opened a couple of weeks ago, and we did a launch there.
Yeah. That's not going to happen in England, bookstore. At least not for the foreseeable future.
Not for
probably sometime in mid-2021 we might have stores opening, but other than that, you know, we just stay in here. Wales, of course, another matter. You've already had your lockdown, so there we are. Let's just build a castle. Jessica, any closing thoughts from yourself?
I have to ask, what's your favorite fantasy book, actually, if I could know, Marie?
Mine to read? Do you know, there's this really old one. It's called The Once and Future King by T.H. White. You won't find it easily anymore, but it's kind of like the grandfather of the sort of Arthurian legends. It's where Walt Disney got The Sword in the Stone from. It's that book. And it's like four books in one, and it carries through from the beginning of Arthur's life to the end of Arthur's life. And it was just magical for me when I read it first when I was an early teenager, maybe 14. And I've read it a couple of times since then, but it's one of my very favorite books, other than the usual, you know, the Lord of the Rings, the Harry Potter series, you know, and all the rest. I read everything that I can find. So, but that one, I would say, is still there in my head after all these years, right? It's still, I can still see scenes from that book. So,
and with further synchronicity, of course, coming up next, we're speaking to a gentleman who runs a shoe manufacturer's who's called Galahad, and his father is Arthur. So there we are. Just go figure, you know.
Oh my gosh.
it's all fitting together in a strange round table-esque way.
Yeah.
I've managed to avoid Robin's challenge of having us pronounce his hometown. I mean, we've got a couple of seconds left. Robin, do you want to actually go for that?
All right, go for it then. Do you remember how it goes?
No, I haven't got a clue.
The name of the town that I live in is Pwllheli.
I was going to say, is it Pwllheli? Because that's right around Nant. I was thinking that. Okay, cool.
Excellent.
Pwllheli.
Very good. Go? That's pretty good, actually. Yeah. How about Jessica? Can you say it?
Yes, exactly.
Pwllheli. You got to kind of stick your tongue up into to your front teeth and then blow the air out the side of your mouth. Pwllheli.
Come on. Yeah? You've watched some Star Trek. Imagine you're talking Klingon.
Oh, okay. Pwllheli?
Very good. All right. Yay. Dayong. As my Welsh teacher used to say, Dayong. I don't know.
Dayong. Very good.
I hope it means something good.
Well,
very good.
I don't think even in his wildest dreams, Mickey Mackelson would have actually thought we'd be talking about Welsh in this particular piece, but it just goes to show how we magically go through that process. Marie, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Have you had an interesting connection with us? Has it been a good Zoomer for yourself?
Oh, lovely. Really wonderful. I'd come back anytime. Ask me back and we'll
talk
more. Well,
there we are. You will return. Fantastic. Robin, likewise, we'll see you again very shortly. And Jessica, we'll see you for a musical treat, hopefully in a few moments from now. Marie Powell, Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, huge thanks. And remember, Spirit Sight and Water Sight, Last of the Gifted, available now.
One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Well, it is Black Friday, and we might well be engaging in hunting out bargains and so on. But if you bear in mind that when it comes to the phenomenon of shoes, we're not talking Imelda Marcos numbers here, 149 million pairs of shoes are being dumped into landfill each year, with 44% of us admitting to binning our shoes when we're done with them, and only 23% recycling them. So to actually talk about ways in which we can cope with this, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First first of all, the Director of Sustainability at Viva Barefoot, the wonderful Emma Foster Gearing. How are you, Emma?
I'm very well. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. And indeed, shoemaker extraordinaire and indeed founder of Vivo Barefoot, it's the wonderful Galahad Clark. How are you, Galahad?
Hi, good, thanks. Good to be here.
Excellent. I must admit, I'm fascinated, just for the benefit of the listener, that we have a wonderful image of yourself in what looks like an ice bath from that point of view there. So hopefully you're not in the bath at present, Galahad, but I suppose we wouldn't know, really. It's a different line entirely. Either way, you'll be barefoot.
No comment. Yeah, I'm definitely barefoot.
Indeed. Excellent. Okay, Emma, let's come to you first. I mean, these numbers are really quite shocking in terms of the ways in which shoes are actually impacting on our environment and so on. And probably we don't think about it. We think, oh, well, you know, the shoe's actually gone. It's not too expensive to get a replacement. We'll just buy another one.
Yeah, it's a little bit out of sight, out of mind, isn't it?
Mm.
I think that the research has really shown a lot of the assumptions and concerns that we've had for the last few years around just the problem of waste. And I think during the lockdown period, especially in the UK, it's been harder than ever to kind of see reality, I think. And so I think this Black Friday, what we've tried to do is really show these statistics and say, this is affecting us, this is affecting our planet, and try and encourage people to think differently about the choices they make.
Galahad, you're obviously the founder of Vivo Barefoot. Is this something which has always been close to your heart in terms of getting sure that or ensuring that there is sustainability and recyclability built obviously into your product?
Oh yeah, this particular project of being able to, as we call it, re-Vivo shoes has been a long time in the coming. We dreamt it up many years ago, and it wasn't until we found a local company in Leeds called the Boot Repair Company that are just absolutely amazing and some of the best cobblers I've ever met in the world. And it was through the partnership with them that we were able to bring it to life. And yeah, we're really proud to be able to do it, but it's been a long dream. Yeah.
Well, Galahad, I mean, I was already thinking you would be well up in our list of quotations of the week with respect to Revivo or Revivo. You know, you say Revivo, I say Revivo. I don't know either way. But to actually say best cobblers you've ever met, that has to be one of the sort of up-lining quotes ever. Emma, returning to yourself, in terms of obviously your involvement with this and the Revivo program, it's exciting news, really, because this is something which I think certainly people might well have been looking for, but not realised they were looking for years now.
Yeah, the industry has been pretty bad at providing solutions and choice for people that actually want to, you know, make a more environmentally conscious decision. And we can see from some of that research that people are not only crying out for those solutions, but they're also willing to pay more for it. And I think that, you know, Vivo Barefoot is quite unique in that they've always had sustainability in the DNA of the organisation. And so Revivo was a labor of love that came to life because we already designed shoes that were wide, thin and flexible and as close to barefoot as possible and therefore as minimal waste as possible. But then bringing the end of life solution to life now, we're now crying out for other brands to do the same and to get the industry to move forward together.
Galahad, how close do you think we are to actually getting that? Or is it, and again, apologies for the pun, but is it you're seeking for the holy grail of shoe recyclability here? I couldn't resist it. Galahad, such a wonderful name.
Well, you know, the sad but true story is my father's Lancelot, so you can have fun with that as well.
This is superb. This is absolutely amazing. You know, I mean, all we need now is for Emma to change her name to Guinevere, and it'll be a whole new world here. But carry on.
Yeah. The Merlin of shoe recycling is still a little way off, honestly. As you probably know, the recycling comes in many different forms. The sort of the holy grail, like you call it, is of shoe recycling is probably chemical recycling, where you can literally bring things back to the same quality of materials. It goes back to a molecular level through some chemical goop, and then you can reach. So at the moment, a plastic bottle kind of gets turned into a fleece or even a material for a pair of shoes. And then it gets turned into, let's say, a Hoover and then maybe a rubbish bin. And it's sort of getting downcycled all the time. Wow. So, you know, the true circularity would be able to bring a plastic bottle back to a plastic bottle grade plastic, shall we say?
Yeah.
So we're still a little ways off that, and it needs massive systems change and cultural change to really get people to stop throwing things away and actually taking them back to places that can recycle them. But you know, we're working on a number of different shoe streams, as it were. Mechanical recycling. We are working on a chemical recycling project, and obviously the repair and refurbish project helps us make better shoes in the first place.
And Emma, where can people go to find out further details about these fabulous initiatives that Vivo Barefoot are introducing?
Yeah, so our main website, vivobarefoot.com, contains all the information around the organization and what we're doing. We've just recently launched our Live Barefoot Foundation, which is where we're really pumping up our investment into regenerative solutions. So things like mushroom mycelium materials and really innovative circularity solutions. And then the other way to go is revivo.com, which is where you can jump on and you can buy refurbished, secondhand, reloved, almost like brand new shoes again. And then just join us on social and get involved in the conversation. We've also got our own podcast called Sustain This, where we interview lots of interesting people. So lots of ways you can join in.
Well, I think it brings us neatly around to two final questions, which we need to ask both of you, of course. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us this morning, Galahad and Emma?
What's a Zoomer?
It's what we're doing now, Emma. It's relating to each other via radio. It's our own phrase in terms of, you know, Zoomers from that point of view. Has it been good for you?
I love it. It's been fantastic. I love the idea of being able to connect with people all around the UK through my phone.
Excellent. It sort of works on a whole variety of other things. Galahad, what about yourself?
It's been Zooming marvellous.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I feel as though we should really have a round table to actually take this further, but never mind, that's a different line. Will you be kind enough to return sometime in the not-too-distant future and maybe share podcasts as well? Will you come back to us?
That would be wonderful. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Excellent. And Galahad Clark and Emma Foster-Gearing, huge thanks from Vivo Barefoot, the founder of Vivo Barefoot, and indeed the director of sustainability at Vivo Barefoot. Huge thanks indeed. And keep on keeping on.
Cheers, Alex.
Well, a recent survey has suggested that when it comes to the environment, it's the male of the species, at least as far as Britain's concerned, that are actually making the more environmentally unfriendly decisions and also taking less responsibility for their actions. Now, to talk us through some of the aspects relating to this and also the Institution of Engineering and Technology's 5 Ways to Be Green in 2021, we're delighted to welcome the ACE individual that is from the Institute of Engineering and Technology's Green Energy area, Olivia Carpenter-Lomax. How are you, Olivia?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Well, I'm clearly a little bit frustrated that it seems that as a bloke that clearly we're making decisions that aren't necessarily the best for the planet, really. Talk us through this research and what it's actually revealed.
Sure. So the IET, the Institute of Engineering Technology Green Preferences Survey, was a survey that was sent out to over 3,000 people in the UK, adults in the UK, and it really aimed to try and understand the public's perception about climate change, about what we can do about it, and where the responsibilities lie. Mm-hmm. And one of the findings, as you say, is a gender difference between men and women, with men maybe taking less personal responsibility for climate change and making actions and changes for climate change, whereas women maybe take slightly more of that responsibility.
I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, we're not talking huge numbers here, and I think slightly more is perfectly apt here, because in terms of recycling plastic, it's 86% of women are more likely to recycle as opposed to 79% of men. Using reusable bottles, that's 59% of women, 47% of men. Okay, a little bit significant there. And then, of course, avoiding products with unnecessary packaging, 52% of women against 46% of men. I think the overall takeaway, surely, is that most of us are very concerned about the environment. We're aware of that. We kind of think that things need to be done. But sometimes it's a case of maybe we take the easy option and say, oh, what the hey, I'll recycle next time.
I think that might be very true. Although, as you say, there is quite a lot of recycling going on. Mm. The survey suggested that 87%, which is a huge percentage, of UK adults are aware of climate change and are aware that human activity is responsible for it, which is a really good start. What it did reveal, though, is that very few adults consider themselves to be up to speed with green changes and green technologies. So there's really more of a knowledge gap, according to the survey.
And certainly that educational element is something which needs to be addressed. I mean, interesting, the recent survey suggested that it's all very well talking about electric cars, but it'll take an electric car to actually go over 50,000 miles before the offset of the production of the actual battery that's actually needed and the resources that are used for that will actually make it any greener than the current sort of fuel monsters. But that's, again, something for debate and another sort of aspect of the system. Within the Institute of, the education technology side of things, are things moving in the right direction? I mean, as the green energy, IET's green energy systems expert, are you generally encouraged by what we're seeing? Or is it a case of, well, we're moving too slow to improperly at present, really? We're not actually moving quickly enough.
Well, there's some fantastically exciting things going on, and we can really feel a change in the attitudes and the cultures and the technologies following that. So green technology is becoming more affordable, more desirable, more exciting, which is exactly what needs to happen. But as you say, there is a worry that maybe we're not moving fast enough, and the IET is trying to change that.
So let's consider these five ways to be green in 2021. And number one, presumably, even in a socially distanced bubble, you need to be careful about shouting. But I think maybe talk more about environmental choices and make environmentally ethical decisions if you can understand what they're about. So asking for better choices will actually help improve the likelihood that people will choose them, presumably.
Yes, absolutely. If industry understand that people want environmental choices, then they will really have to start taking this seriously.
Understandably, the second one, the electric vehicle bandwagon, no pun intended there, has had a number of criticisms, one of which I mentioned earlier in terms of, well, what about the cost of producing the battery and the things that go in from that side of things there. And of course, there was the concern that has been frequently raised by a number of people about, well, we were all told to go diesel, it was better for the environment, and that proved to be a complete non-starter. So what are we going with respect to this? Is that more of a challenge to overcome in terms of how people will actually engage with different personalised forms of transport?
Yeah, education around those kinds of issues is really important. We're finding, though, that the main barrier is actually just not understanding the technology and being worried about things like running out of charge. So it's tackling those kinds of things that needs to be the answer for electric vehicles. And what we found really is that once people try an electric vehicle, they're normally quite happy with it and can really start to see themselves using electric vehicles. Mm. So perhaps if you were to hire an electric vehicle, if you're worried about what it feels like or what it means to try and find charging stations, if you hire a vehicle and give it a go, then you might find that it's more fun than you think.
I think it's certainly a case of the pandemic aspect has meant that rather than actually moving to more public forms of transport, if anything, it's driven more people, understandably, into the individualised personal bubbles of cars and so on. I mean, from my own point of view, working in education, there hasn't been any evidence really that the roads have gotten any quieter. And if anything, they've gotten actually more busy and congested as a result. But that, I suppose, is a byproduct of ensuring that we actually stay safe and don't actually contaminate.
Yeah, absolutely. Although the other side of COVID is that, of course, it's been almost a real life experiment about what happens if the whole of society decides to act in a different way. And we've kind of exercised and tested out technologies in logging in from home and remote meetings and things. So it might mean that we need to travel less in the future if we can do more of those things from home.
So that's very true. Of course, Olivia, I think one has to be very careful about saying it's been a real-life experiment. There are lots of conspiracy theorists out there who'll say, that's it, exactly, it is a real-life experiment. They just haven't told us. Anyway, we'll step away from that. It's also important to note that actually just doing the traditional things, such as insulation, upgrading windows, draft-proofing, etc., they can all actually make huge differences to energy savings and therefore better for the planet, presumably.
Absolutely. Your home and buildings and the insulation for those buildings is hugely influential about how much heating you need. And heating is a really big proportion of your energy use in your home. So the more you can keep the heat in, the more green you're going to be.
Yeah. And something which I'm personally 100% convinced about now, having finally sussed out the technology and actually using, assuming decent broadband is actually there for students and staff, etc., the benefits of actually reducing our travel by simply actually working from home, logging in from home, etc. I mean, as we're doing today, I mean, back in, shall we say, the days of 2019, we would have been heading to different studios. We would have obviously had a carbon footprint from actually going to those studios. We would have connected from that basis. As it stands, we're able to actually produce this, develop it for Siren Radio, Southside Broadcasting, and so on. And we haven't had to actually add anything in terms of our carbon footprint at all because we've worked from home.
Absolutely. And there are plenty of people in business who have been in the habit of traveling around the world to go to meetings and to interact with clients internationally. And the more we can cut down on that flying, the better.
Yeah. And perhaps if people are actually missing the physical content, or physical contact, in fact, maybe it's a case of putting some research into those tactile sensory-based suits that you can obviously wear, or gloves to can actually give you the simulation of that as well. Just a thought, just a line from that, which we can maybe talk about. Finally, Olivia, where can people go to find out more detail about the Institute of Engineering Technology's Green Energy Report and ways in which we can see how you can also make a difference through some of those five aspects we've already spoken about?
Sure, there's loads of information on the IET website, that is theiet.org. And if you go to theiet.org/green preferences survey, that's green-preferences-survey, then you'll be able to find the report and have a good read.
And from your own perspective, Olivia, has there been any particular changes that you've applied which you thought, oh, I wasn't thinking about that, but you've actually noted it's made a big difference? Or is it a case of, you know, you take step-by-step approaches like the rest of us?
Really, yeah, it's step-by-step approaches and exploring what those little changes look like. So what does it look like to eat a little bit less meat, or to try and save a little bit of energy? And step-by-step, I think we can, the whole of society can change to become a little bit more in touch with its impact on the environment.
And step by step certainly ties in with an earlier report we were doing on the importance of recycling shoes as well. So it all sort of fits together in one holistic bubble of positivity, which is great stuff. Olivia Carpenter-Lomax from the Institute of Engineering and Technology's Green Energy Area, huge thanks indeed. Happy holidays and stay safe.
And you, thank you very much.